and welcome to the Advanced Age Role Play Gamers podcast. I'm Nathan. I'm one of your co-hosts today, and I've got with me Matt. Say hi, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
That's just a joke. We do this every time. Anybody who's watched our interviews is probably really sick and tired of that by now. But
it's a good joke.
Today we've got the creators behind Coriolis and the new Kickstarter for, I'm going to get this wrong, The Great Dark. Nils,
that's me. Nils,
and Costa.
Hi.
They're from Free League Publishing. Guys, if you can give me just a quick bit about yourselves, how you got started gaming and what you do at Free League and other products you've gone, just the first couple minutes here, just let's sure. get to know you a little bit.
I can start. Mm-hmm. So I'm Nils. I'm one of the co-founders of Free League. It was founded back in 2009, I think, something like that. And we actually were founded because of me and Costa's work with the first published edition of Coriolis, which was another company back in 2008. So this is kind of coming back to the roots for us. But I've been playing tabletop RPGs since I was 5 years old. My father introduced Dragonbane, actually, or Drakkar and Demoner, as it was called then, to me in the Christmas of 82. So I've been playing for quite a while. Wow. And it's been like one of the main hobbies of my life, probably the main hobby. So being able to work with this full time is like crazy. It's like a dream come true.
That's excellent. That's, you know, I think we talked to a lot of folks, and that's everybody's dream. I hope everybody can get there, but it's a lot of hope out there.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, as Nils said, we started working with Coriolis. I actually started a bit before Nils, working as a freelancer for the old company Jan Ring and writing a setting for Coriolis in 2008 or something. We actually met that way.
Yeah.
Because I had to audition to his group to get to play Coriolis at all.
It was stupid.
Anyway, I started playing when I was 14. So it was like in 1987. Same game as Nils, Drakkar Demoner, with some friends in school, us the nerds. And and I never stopped playing, actually. A few years I had a hiatus, you could say.
Yeah, Matt and I met in high school and started playing like D&D together. But our group, if anybody watching this doesn't know, we've been we're about 7 episodes in on a so far recorded 25 episodes of Dragonbane, and we've been having so much fun. Probably the reason why it's gone so long. Most of our actual plays are like 11 to 15 episodes. So this much Dragon Bane is great. It's a breath of fresh air. I love the setting. I love the play. It's anyway, not here to talk about Dragon Bane, but every time anybody brings it up, I have to gush about it. So it's a lot of fun. The setting for Coriolis, I've heard it described as, I just lost my brain for a second there.
Like 1001 Arabian Nights in space.
Arabian Nights. So I've heard it described as Arabian Nights in space. So was that like an intentional thing, or is that just something somebody said once and you kind of latched on to it,
it's both, I think. It's actually because in the very first edition of Coriolis, that part was not as emphasized as in the second, our version, which was the Third Horizon. There was influence of especially Eastern mythology and history and culture in the aesthetics of the first edition. And in our version, Third Horizon, we took that and ramped it up a bit. Mm-hmm. But it was mostly... I mean, it is the main thing with Coriolis, I think, is that it's not based on Anglo-Saxon Western mythology. That's the main thing. This Arabian Nights is one thing to kind of convey that it's a different cultural cornerstone or background, but it's it was never specifically Arabian Nights. It was never specifically about that part. It was just kind of the feeling.
Yeah. The high level pitch, I would say.
Yes, yeah, it was a high level pitch.
Arabian Night meets Firefly.
Yeah,
everybody.
I like that too. That's definitely brings an image to my head.
Yeah. So it kind of took out on its life of its own. But for us, it was never kind of that wasn't the core of the game. It was a big part of the game.
So first. Probably the first and probably only really tough question I have for you is how do you borrow from these other cultures that you might not be a part of and do that in a respectful and kind of egalitarian manner?
That's a super tricky question and a good question.
Yeah, I know. That's one tricky question.
It's a good question. It's kind of one way in why we're kind of toning it down a bit for this game. We still want to have it in the background. We still want to have it based on the old game, but we don't want to go full on in this kind of diving into another culture where we don't really know all the different aspects of it. Yeah. So, but in the old game, we were more going for the aesthetics of it.
Yeah.
And we're basing it on the mythology and not on, for example, there's no, Islam is not part of the whole game. It's not like real religions. It's not like real history.
Jan Ringen developed the first game, they were very adamant that they shouldn't have churches or synagogues or minarets or anything. Everything was called temples. There should be religion, but it shouldn't be specified to anything you could get from Earth, so to say.
Yeah.
But the feeling that there's something mystic, something out there.
Yeah, but it is a very good question. I mean, and that's something we've been pondering quite a bit ourselves, of course. So we don't really have a straight cut answer to it, except that do it carefully and with respect and try to kind of figure out what we're looking for. And in our case, in this game's case, it's just making it feel a bit different than to all the other science fiction games that are based on kind of this Western kind of feeling.
Right. Yeah. So, and that's a good goal too. Is even like a lot of the fantasy games are heavily based on Western mythos and aesthetic. So, I definitely think that's a pretty good goal for especially for a science fiction game. So I really like the Expanse for the way they treat that whole aspect. So.
I think Dune is another example that tries to do that and does it very well, where they go for this kind of clearly inspired by Eastern history and mythology, but not particularly anything of that. And that's kind of the same kind of vibe we're going for.
And a lot of inspiration is also historical from Byzantium and Eastern Mediterranean area, sort of historically or in the antique.
Yeah. One thing, that's actually a good thing, because one thing that's kind of fallen off people's radar is that we used the Arabian Nights as the kind of the high-level pitch, but a lot of the culture and the aesthetics was inspired by Greece. Costa is Greek himself, so kind of that was a big part of it. And also Byzantium, as you said, and Constantinople, that part. So has been different parts of the world that has influenced kind of the feeling of it, not just one part.
Yeah, that's good. So in a quick background for the folks watching too, I have not personally played Coriolis. I'm going to leave a lot of that Coriolis specific stuff to Matt. I've gone through, there's a quick start available now through their Kickstarter page that you can download, and there's pre-gen characters already in there you can try out, which is pretty cool. And I've been going through that. So there's for folks that are not familiar with Coriolis. So we've gone a little bit about about the setting. What are the types of scenarios, adventures, and even like archetypes should they expect in a Coriolis game?
So we want the adventures to have like three parts, We want to have intrigue, which is in the beginning when you set up an expedition and when you travel through space where different factions interact with each other and with the PCs to get favors from each other. Mm-hmm. But it's also about exploration and delving into ruins and finding, solving mysteries from the past. And that's the later part of an adventure. So you okay. should get all these parts in an adventure, both intrigue, expeditions, and also delving down into ruins. That's the aim.
Yeah. And
Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, for folks who maybe have not played any of the Coriolis before, so the setting that I have that I'm more familiar with is based around, it's basically this, you know, if I butcher something wrong, I'm sorry. Like, you know, humanity has spread to what they call the third horizon, right? And that's a place in space. And I think most of the adventures are centered around a large space station, right? Coriolis, yep. right? Yep. Which was the built from the hulk of one of the ships that brought humanity there, right? And there's like a couple different waves of humanity. And that's that cultural tension, right?
Yep. Yep.
But in the great, this is, you're talking about these going out on these explorations. So maybe you could, so if folks aren't familiar, that's what it is. But this new version kind of changes the setting and sort of and kind of the feel. Maybe you could just kind of let folks know what they sure. can expect in this new version.
Yeah. I mean, the new version, basically it takes place about 200 years after the old one. The old one has this epic campaign that changes up a lot of things. So this is basically kind of an offshoot of that. And basically, the old setting, as you said, was called the Third Horizon. A horizon is like a cluster of star systems. And this setting is called the Lost Horizon. And people from the former horizon fled to this one during a big calamity. So this could be called the Fourth Horizon or the Lost Horizon. It doesn't matter. But it's another star cluster. This one is more... is less open, it's more mysterious, and it's dotted with these huge ruins from the portal builders that existed in the old as well. But this seems closer to kind of their home. Mm-hmm. And when the humanity comes to this one, escaping stuff in the Third Horizon, they kind of get stranded here because there's no portals. All the portals that people use to travel between systems are dead in this horizon. And they seem to be dead for some reason, which is part of the mystery you're going to explore. So this is the new setting is a more frontier feeling, a more dangerous feeling, a bit more gritty feeling than the older one, which was more kind of a golden age kind of thing with this cultural tension, as you said. This one has the cultural thing in, as well, but it's humanity and civilization is more small scale. Mm. So you kind of help building this new kind of part of humanity to survive in this new difficult environment. And this game is about hope. The former game was basically about faith, about religion, and this game is more about hope, which faith could be a part of, but it's not specifically about religion. It's more about pulling together and doing stuff together and kind of creating a new home for humanity. So it's a shift in tone. It's a shift in the setting where the setting starts smaller, but when you go out and explore and explore it, it's going to open up. You're going to see about much more. Mm. And the main reason we did this was that the old game, which we love, of course, we wrote it, is that that's basically a huge sandbox. Loads of different factions and cultures and planets, but there's no clear-cut focus of the game. So it's very difficult to write material for it. It's like mm-hmm. Traveller in that sense. It's like a huge sandbox. You can do anything with it, but you can't really do any focus development because people will have different play styles, different play groups. You can play a traveling circus. You can play pilgrims. You can play mercenaries. Mm. And that's cool, but it's not a game that's easy to develop for. So we wanted to kind of make this game a bit more focused and a bit more focused on what we think is the sci-fi and the mystery parts, which was always, the old game was supposed to be about that. And that is the mystery of the builders,
we were intrigued by those parts of the old setting when we first started writing about the portrait builders. Where did they go? But this was never touched upon in the Third Horizon. That the adventures were more about war and espionage
And Firefly kind of game. Yeah. So the old game is much more Firefly-esque.
Yeah.
And that's a cool thing. But there's lots of space games doing Firefly kind of. I mean, Star Wars and all of them.
Mm.
Yeah. When you zip around in a small spaceship, and we wanted to kind of change this one, so it's more based on 19th century polar expedition and ocean faring vessels.
Yeah. Okay.
And a frontier feeling where civilization hasn't spread. So the high level pitch is the Terror, the series meets Deadwood, although there are no cowboys. It's a frontier feeling of Deadwood.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a romantic take on sci-fi in that the we call it the Great Dark. Obviously the Great Dark is space and the Great Dark is the sea. It is the sea of the old polar explorers, and it's dark and it's wild and it's dangerous, and going out on these journeys is going to be an adventure in itself. So we tried to make this setting, this game, a bit more about the exploration and about the romantic parts of the setting, we think.
Hmm. Yeah. I can definitely
I can definitely feel the when you keep mentioning the frontier setting, and just going through the quick start, I can kind of see that, because if you're going from a golden age to the frontier, one of the things you lose out on are resources. And I see that there's a whole supply resource management aspect just even in the quick start. So can you talk about why you put the, I can kind of see why you put that in there, but can you talk about that mechanic a little bit?
Supply thing, it comes from, we've been very inspired by deep sea diving and mountaineering and those kind of vertical exploration things that you have, instead of a lot of games have, you come to a place, it could be a dungeon, it could be a space station, whatever, and go around in a top-down map. We wanted to kind of focus more about going downwards or upwards and kind of into the unknown. And supply here is a thing to kind of make the PCs feel limited in what they can do, forcing important choices.
Yeah.
So if your supplies are running low, you have to make a choice. Should we go left or right, or should we explore that cave or that cave, or what should we do? Should we split up? So it's a way of making sure that you have this urgency when you're exploring, which is also, I mean, the real life explorers have that. They have to make sure they have resources and food and so on. So it's a way of making cool.
Yeah, it's not like a dungeon where, you know, we go to through every room looking for a treasure.
No.
You have to decide, okay, this, how far can we go before we have to turn back around? And
But this part is only used when you're out exploring ruins or in dangerous places. When you're in, for example, Ship City, which is the equivalent of Coriolis in this game, it's a big station. You don't use supply rules, of course. Or if you're on a big ship going out, there's not supply rules for your group. It's going to be other stuff.
Yeah.
So it's just, this is a mechanic that we wanted to create for kind of emphasize the feeling of delving into the unknown and kind of forcing hard changes.
Yeah.
Choices.
Yeah, and that's space all part of the whole delving. Sorry.
That's
sorry.
All right.
I'll let you go in a second.
We need like a
red light.
Right.
But so this is all part of the, so you've got the home base setting, you've got the exploration portion, and then you have the delving and the supply aspect as part of the delving system that you're talking about, exploring up and down vertical situations. So I'm taking that whole mechanic idea wasn't even part of the old Third Horizon Coriolis. This is something new to the Great Dark.
Yeah. And what we've changed to is we've taken away the Firefly part in a big part. Mm-hmm. So now when you travel, between star systems, you have to go on great ships, like in the explorers. They had a ship with a big crew with different tasks during the travel through the dark. And you have to, and you can, in that way, you can also bring the intrigue from your homestead with you. So the different factions can continue doing intriguing stuff during the whole trip out, which should take weeks or months in some cases.
Yeah. I think we played a lot of Firefly games, of course, our own as well. But that kind of a weakness, it could be a strength as well, is what Costa said, is when you go out in your spaceship, you're only your small crew, and you zip around and you go to an adventure and you zip back to the base or wherever, and then you have intrigue and stuff there. And we just wanted to kind of bring along the intrigue and the people on the adventure. So instead of just having two separate parts, you kind of meld them together a bit, and then you can have rival crews going after the same thing. You can have, you know, you can have a murder mystery on the voyage. You can have sabotage. You can have, you know, strange findings and so on. So it opens up a lot of role playing possibilities, which makes it more, I think, more interactive in a way than just teleporting with a small spaceship.
Yeah, it's. It was Star Wars that can happen sometimes. It's like, okay, I'm just going to make this hyper jump.
Yeah.
And okay, we're there. Matt, what was your
question? Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, exploration in space is clearly dangerous in itself, right? But you guys aren't happy with that. You've thrown something else in there waiting for people, right? Did you guys want to talk about the blight?
Sure.
Yeah, you go ahead.
Okay.
Go
ahead. The blight is this strange kind of growth that exists down in the ancient ruins of the portal builders. And the more kind of rare ruins, the more kind of valuable stuff there is, the more blight there is. So it has some kind of connection to what was once there. And the blight is it's like a mix of radiation and of poisonous ivy and of not body horror, and it's not that. But if you've seen Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation, this kind of organic kind of weirdness. So this frames the ruins and these old sites. When you explore them, you have this blight phenomena to always kind of beware of, because it's very dangerous, and it has some mystical kind of strangeness to it. So you can end up in strange places if you're too exposed to it.
And the blight, so we built that into the rules a lot. So now you have blight protection. You have to wear suits like divers, basically, to and maybe sanitize yourself or turn back to a base camp to heal up. But you also have the bird now, which is the mystical part of the game, which can counter the blight in some cases.
Yeah, so it's this is all tied to kind of the meta plot and to the history of the setting and so on, but it's a way of making these ruins and the player characters being kind of these expert divers and explorers. So they're one of the few that can brave this blight and go out and do this dangerous stuff, much like deep sea divers in say the 50s or 60s with these huge suits. So that's one part. And blight is very dangerous. And people in the ship city, that the core, they're afraid of blight coming to that because it's contagious and it corrupts stuff. So there's lots of plots you can do with the blight that is not part of delving or ruin hunting. You can have it in other parts. There's going to be sicknesses tied to it. Some factions actually look for blight because they can do drugs from it. They can do other stuff.
Okay.
It's a plot point. It's like Melange, the spice in Dune, but a bit more dangerous.
Yeah, I was thinking, gosh, whatever that stuff, Altered Carbon. Remember there's the show Altered Carbon.
Yeah.
That proto whatever molecule, getting vibes from that. Okay. So now the birds. Yeah. So explain the bird. So they are sort of a mystical. They're sort of a phenomenon as well, right? And that's every
actual
party.
Bird.
Right. And it's right. That's the thing, too. It's like, well, like it's a bird, like a lot of, you know, and but
they're not real birds.
No, they look like birds.
Yeah.
But right, some but they're construct biological entity.
They were found, when humanity came here, they were found these birds, and they have a very specific purpose, as if someone left it to someone to discover.
And as I understand what I read, each group, that'll be part of every group will have a bird, and that bird can be developed, right?
Yeah.
That there will be rules to develop. Yeah.
Yeah.
We have something like that called Miserable Beast. It's a mystical donkey.
It doesn't protect anybody.
But it's basically a canary bird from a gas mine, basically. But this one
looks
a bit cooler, and it has mystical powers.
Yeah.
And it is somehow tied to the blight, but it can counter the blight.
Yeah.
And its powers is constructed to kind of battle the blight. That's why it's so important for explorer groups to have a bird, because without the bird, it's super dangerous to do that. But the bird helps the groups.
Yeah.
So whose idea was the bird, and did it strictly come from the canary in a coal mine type idea?
That's our illustrator, Martin Grip.
Yeah, we saw pictures of, what do you call them, falconeers.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Birds. Mm-hmm. So that's... I think it was Cossacks.
But it ties back to kind of the vision of Coriolis, that Coriolis is kind of, it's not hard sci-fi, it's not space opera, it's science fiction that meets kind of mythology. And the birds is kind of a mythical beast in this case, which makes it feel like a bit different than, for example, you know, Star Wars or Alien.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's kind of a way of building atmosphere as well.
Yeah. And it's also tied to the mystical powers in the Lost Horizon. In the Third Horizon, the players could have mystical powers. They might develop them, who knows, in when you play the Great Dark. But in the beginning, nobody has mystical powers.
Yeah.
So that's contained in the birds.
That was one part of the old game we weren't really satisfied with, how mystical powers worked. So we tried to make a better version in this one. And most of it will be discovered during play.
Yeah.
But the bird is kind of the first manifestation of this.
So when we talked to Thomas Harenstam about Mutant Year Zero, I asked him about lessons learned, because he was kind of floating the idea of maybe there'll be another a second edition of that. Besides the mysticality, what are some of the other lessons learned that you're changing from the first edition, Third Horizon, to the
loads.
Yeah, we're changing loads. So, yeah. But one big part we're changing is that we're merging talents and skills to one group called talents now, and they are more specialized, not as broad as they used to be in Year Zero engine or in old Coriolis. So you have a lot of more choices, and you can specialize in stuff that other people won't be able or be as good as you in. But you also have higher levels in your attributes, so you can do a lot with just attributes without being, you know, a loser.
Yeah. There's always this classic problem. If you have too many skills, then, of course, some PCs will lack some important skills, and then you would be very, very bad at it. So we raised the attributes and made the skills tighter but more descriptive. Yeah. And that's also to make the characters a bit more memorable and a bit more specific. So the talents kind of can be used to describe a character in this game.
So we're not just, I'm a pilot 2 and he's a pilot 3.
Yeah.
And this is something more.
Yeah. So that's one of the changes. In the old game, we had darkness points, which was his meta currency. Mm-hmm. And that was a cool idea, but it had some problems with it. Namely that you could, because it basically, it gave, when you push rolls, it gave the GM darkness points that you can use to create bad stuff, which is cool. But the problem is, if you don't have any darkness points, it's tricky to introduce bad stuff, and you still want to do that sometimes. So it's kind of, it can tie the GM in a strange kind of loop that sometimes doesn't work. So we scrapped that and focused on other parts here and tied the pusher mechanic to hope instead.
Yeah,
you mentioned hope. So I was going through the character sheets and kind of doing some comparisons. I noticed, right, so skills are out, the talent system. There are more attributes, right? We've added a couple attributes. But then I noticed that you have hope and heart are two. And I know earlier you mentioned about kind of this idea of having a goal, of being able to like achieve something better for your group and all this. And I was kind of curious about the hope and heart and how you guys use this in this. I know when Nathan and I were at Gen Con last year, we ran into a few different game developers. where like hope, heart, positive, you know, so much like in the future is like dystopian, but we started seeing creators wanting to provide good outcomes, right? Yeah. Things that, that make you, you know, that's all depressing. And I'm wondering this sort of hope, the heart, how is this tied in your game? How do you see people using these attributes and like, how are they tied in with like their goals?
As you said, it's true that, I mean, why we introduce hope and heart and that stuff is because it is a pretty dark setting. It's mm-hmm. a wild, it's greedy, it's dangerous. So, but if you only paint everything in one tone, it gets kind of monotonous. So we wanted to mm-hmm. contrast that with something that is more hopeful, that is more optimistic. And so this game is about finding a way forward, even against all odds and so on. Those tracks, health and hope. No, there's three tracks, actually. There's health, there's hope, and there's heart. And the game, kind of game loop, if you want, is kind of centered about the slow attrition of these. So exploration is more about the attrition, about something that slowly they're chipping away at those, and you kind of feel like, oh, we got to take a break soon because this guy has broken his leg and he's out of air and so on. And so we use these three tracks to kind of create this constant push on the players from the environment, from enemies, and from other stuff to kind of create this pressure on players when they're out in these dangerous situations.
Yeah. So they start at a starting level, and then so the idea is that as they go through these sort of tough situations, these are reduced. At some point, they have to return. They have to, you know, have to come up for air. You have to, you know, whatever that means. There's a way to recover those.
Yeah, it is. Here's a way to recover. And basically, you can strike camps. You can help each other. You can use hope to help other. You can kind of strike, rally morale and so on. Mm. So there's a lot about helping each other to recover and push on. Mm. So it's kind of, I mean, it's not, the game is not about mountaineering or deep sea diving, but it's kind of the same feeling that, you know, one person is falling behind, the other ones need to kind of bring him or her up and, you know, help them. Mm. This is like a contrast to a game like Alien, for example. Alien, I mean, is a great game of stabbing your friend in the back and dying in the process. So this game is more hopeful, and that's very intentional.
And that and the hope track is also your resource for pushing. So if you have hope, you can push. You can give hope to other members of the crew to help them. But if you're lost hope, you're desperate, and you have to stop or turn back. And heart goes down when the blight affects you. And if you finally get broken by the blight, you go down to zero. Weird stuff happens.
Yeah. So there are health is tied to combat and damage. Hope is tied to pushing on and horrors and stuff and stress. And as Costa said, heart is tied to blight, especially. And mysteries and mystical things.
Yeah.
So been following Free League for a while. I kind of see this as the eventual track is that you're going to release probably campaigns that start to uncover the mystery of what the blight is and what happened to the people that created the portals. Is that kind of where we're going with this down the road?
Yeah, definitely. That's exactly. Yeah, pretty much. So you can find about you with the first campaign, you will learn about one mystery and solve that, but that will uncover another mystery for the second campaign.
Yeah.
And the third.
And that's a big lesson we learned with the old Coriolis was we did this huge campaign, but instead of, you know, exposing the mysteries for the players, it's lots of background, lots of front loading with stuff for the GM. But what gets to the players is a trickle of this cool stuff. So we wanted to change how we write campaigns and make it more kind of player facing. Mm. So you get quicker to the cool stuff without, you know, it shouldn't be forced in any way. But so the campaigns we construct for this one are smaller in scope, but they come to kind of the game juice a bit quicker.
Yeah. And they come to a conclusion. I mean, in the old games, you had, you know, one campaign book every year or every second year. So you had to wait 5 years to conclude the campaign. Here you will get the campaign, when you buy the game now, you will play mm-hmm. through it, and the next year we will get a new campaign.
Yeah, but they're tied together, but in a loose sense. So that way you don't have gaming groups that kind of like, oh, we can't play this because we're waiting 2 years for Free League to get our act together.
Right.
So it's a different way of creating adventures and campaign for this game.
And also one thing I've seen too with a lot of the third-party licensing stuff that's been going on the past couple of years with role-playing games. Is there going to be a third-party license where folks can create their own Coriolis material?
Yeah.
Yep.
We're going to do that. We're going to do that for both games, actually. So for Coriolis the Third Horizon, we will have an open gaming license. For a lot of people are already creating in the Free League Workshop. And we want people to continue creating stuff for the Third Horizon. We won't be developing it any further, right. but it's a lot of people love the setting and they will probably continue.
You can still play it, and it still has lots of, I mean, you have years of play in that setting if you like. So this kind of passing on the torch to the fan base who are already doing lots of stuff for that.
Yeah. We'll also have an OGL for Coriolis the Great Dark. And they're both the same sort of license as we've had for Dragonbane, which is which turned out very good.
Yeah, so it's basically you can use the world, the setting, the rules, and create your own products, and you don't pay anything to us. There's one thing you still need to use the core rules. That's it. But you can create your own campaign. You can create your own source book or whatever.
Yeah, and you can kickstart your campaign and you can sell it and stuff like that.
So it's a way to invite kind of the community, the ones that are interested in doing that, to kind of, you know, do something more with their ideas.
I think that really, really helps because there's I bought like a ton of treasure cards for Dragonbane from this, Philip Reed. And it's been just all the excitement, and there's I backed another Kickstarter for Dragonbane also. There's just a lot of excitement when people can like take your foundation and add their own spin to it, because the mechanics stuff is getting those right is super hard for anybody who's just starting out. But a lot of people have great imaginations and you're very talented with art and layout and design, and they can do all that stuff. But just building on what you created is kind of a way for them to fulfill those dreams of working in the RPG industry.
Yeah, so I think that's also cool. One of the cool parts with RPGs. It's like it's this fundamentally creative hobby. Where people, I mean, just by playing, you create stuff, but, you know, writing down notes or thinking about adventures and campaigns. And that's how it started for us. We started doing stuff for other companies' games. And it's just a fun way of, I think it's like a communal gaming experience where people do stuff that we had never thought about. And it's like, this is, their idea is better than ours. That's cool.
Exactly.
So it's very cool, and that's what it's very fun with Dragonbane to see that people are starting doing lots of stuff with it.
There's a ton of stuff.
So I have to, for a lot of folks play now virtually. So VTT support plans for VTC. So I saw some stuff on the Kickstarter side, but I don't know if that was all of it. So how do you guys plan to integrate with the VTTs?
So Alchemy is supported right away. It's included in Kickstarter. And Alchemy has this kind of light and atmosphere heavy approach to VTTs, which suits our games pretty well. It's not so much about advanced function, but more about building this tone and atmosphere and immersion. Foundry VTT will also be, it's an add-on in the Kickstarter, but that will be a come as well. And Foundry is, I would say, for the more, if you want a bit more crunch, a bit more tools, Foundry is the choice to go for. That's the two one that the main two ones we're going for right now. We'll probably add more later on, but especially for the Foundry, it's quite heavy to develop modules for it. So it takes time and resources. So we try to focus on a couple first and make them good, and then we can see if we can expand it instead of promising like all the different platforms.
And just to take a step back and dive into the setting, into the setting a little bit more. There's a ton of factions, and just the factions that are in Quick Start, are those the same factions that are in the Third Horizon, or are these all new, or some new, some old?
Well, there's some new and some old, and there's also a melange of the old ones into the new. So this setting is 200 years after the Third Horizon. So a lot of people that were in different factions traveled to the Lost Horizon, and then when the new power players of Ship City developed over time, they became the new factions. But they have roots in different factions, more or less.
Yeah, and you will see that more when you go to the core rulebook and campaigns and so on. For example, there's this faction called the Black Toad, which is basically a crime syndicate. And that is the direct ascendant of a faction which is not at all a crime syndicate in the Third Horizon, which basically just switched sides and became this powerhouse of kind of crime and intrigue and drug distribution in this game. And it makes kind of sense in the plot behind it, but it's not apparent until you kind of, you know, scrape away under the surface. Yeah. So they're connected, but it's not obvious. It's not like this became this, and these are the good guys or bad guys. It's kind of intermingled.
See, so, one thing I wanted to touch on earlier too was the characters. What type of archetypes are going to be featured in this game?
So the ones you would expect. So we have developed different archetypes, and each archetype has previous occupations. But when you start the game, you move into the Explorer Guild and become a professional explorer. So your archetype is your background. So you could be an enforcer, or you could be a worker, or an artist. But the artist has different previous occupations. So an enforcer could have been a guild militia or an private investigator. Artist could be a hull painter or something else.
Yeah, so we have this kind of broad archetypes that are kind of easy to identify with because you know what a kind of soldier is. But we try to, as Coriolis is a lot about building atmosphere and kind of going deeper than that. There's the previous occupation, the custom mentions, they're full of this cultural flavor. So all of those have a lot more kind of unique takes on different
and integrated to the settings.
So you won't never be like, I'm an artist, you're a soldier, and I'm a medic. That's not how you play this game. You have the specific ties to the setting, which is makes, we think, for like fuller characters. But that's not in the Quick Start. That's something that would be in the rule book, and we're writing that part right now. Yeah.
So we will have a extensive character generation chapter where you get your previous occupations, you get your heirloom from the Third Horizon, you develop what district in Ship City you grew up in or in the Far Colonies or wherever. A lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's like a life path in miniature almost system where you get...
You beat me to it. So that's it really sounds a little bit like kind of the Twilight 2000.
Yeah, but this is more streamlined and less detailed, but kind of the same thing that you want to have. I grew up here, I became this, this is where I am now, this is my stuff, this is why I'm going.
And each of those parts of the background, do they feed into the talents that the characters get? Or is that
talents and equipment.
Okay.
And also, as Costa mentioned, there's this as the technology in this game is less advanced than the former game because of the scarcity of repair parts and so on, spare parts. So heirlooms from the old Third Horizon are really, really valued. So you have this different. You can have weapons. You can have scanners or different stuff that you inherited from some relative or something that comes from and has a backstory tied to the old game and it also has a powerful function. So technology is more rare, but more, it's not magic in any way, but it's more like when you have something that is really good at something, it's more special in this game.
And also it breaks down like it does in the original Mutant Zero game.
Yeah.
I saw that there's a mechanic if you push with an item, right? Yeah. You can, for every one, right? It reduces its durability or its level, right? Yeah.
And that's also to push this kind of scarcity theme that equipment breaks, and you have to, you know, repair it. You have to pull your resources and so on, and which makes exploration and different parts dangerous in a way.
So you're climbing down the shaft into a ruin, and you have to push your climbing, and you use your harpoon gun, and it sort of breaks down. So next time, it will be harder to cross the
or you would have to strike camp and repair it, and then you waste air and stuff. So it's technology is a bit different, but it's kind of the same vibe, but more scarce.
Yeah,
I think that makes for a grittier setting. It's when you think about some games and you look at the characters and they're just kitted out to the hilt with like every piece of gear they'll ever need on their back and I definitely like a more scarce type situation where the players have to kind of fight for every little thing that they get, and it's makes things a little bit harder than the Die Hard approach
And I think it comes back to player choice, because if you have access to all the cool stuff from the beginning, if you have everything, well, there's no reason not to pick the best stuff or have the best.
Yeah.
You have to have some trade-off or something to make you... you can do that with other stuff. You can do that with encumbrance, or we do that in this game as well. But it's more fun, we think, to have this kind of... you have a spear gun, I have this staff, but it's good for the bird. It's not a game about always having the best weapons. It's having the best tools for what you're doing in that particular moment.
If you have everything, why would you go out exploring?
Right. That's always a thin line with sci-fi, is because, high technology is indistinguishable from magic, right? So if everyone can fly and everyone can see in the dark it's where's the danger, having that.
It's like cell phones in modern horror movies or something. If you have a cell phone, you can always call for help, but they never do because... So right. You have to find a way around that.
Right. Home Alone, that old movie Home Alone.
Yeah.
He couldn't call, right? You couldn't make that movie today, right?
No.
You see them on their camera, It's like, I got you.
Technology is cool, but it can also put, it could stop this kind of thoughts of adventure if it's too powerful.
Yeah.
Well, its core tenet is to make our life easier. That's not fun. Yeah. That's not an adventure, right?
And like Wally and those floating chairs. So the campaign is close to wrapping up. I think we're shooting this on a Thursday. I think you've got about a week left.
Yep.
Yeah. Are all the stretch goals met yet, or
they are
still some
stuff? Yeah. But we're gonna add a few more tomorrow.
Yeah, we had some.
We used that
in the pipeline.
Yeah, but we have to figure out exactly what. Because
what order?
We're not in agreement over this.
Ah, I guess you guys are a dirty trick to throw dice. And I went in. We did the Kickstarter today, and I got done. I was like, okay, and then it's like, would you like to add dice? I'm like, oh, come on, guys.
In the box already.
Well, I've got another set coming because you can never
have
any dice.
No.
Well, it kind of today actually we unlocked the solo rules, which is going to be into the core book, and that's going to be written by Sean Tomkin and Matt Click. And Sean Tomkin has written these really, really good solo rules for Iron Sworn and Starforged.
Oh, okay.
And those are really popular. Well. So really excited, and he's been looking at the game and kind of see where he can do some solo things. So that's going to be really cool that you can play. This is the first time you can play like solo in Coriolis.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. That's something that I've seen in a lot of other free league games recently. And solo gaming is becoming a lot more popular now.
It's huge demand for that. From our customers, it's like if we don't do a solo mode, people are upset.
I was surprised to discover that. I mean, so I when I was young, I when couldn't get a game, I'd done it. I just didn't know that. It's like, oh, I'm just I'm the guy who can't find anyone to game this weekend, right? But then you find out there's tons of people who, right, for life circumstances, can't get a regular group or whatever, and solo play. And so, I totally applaud it. I think it's a great addition to the game. You know, yeah, I think a lot of, we all love the stories.
Have a limited amount of time, and they maybe have, you know, kind of kids and stuff or careers, and this is a way for them to kind of interact with the game anyway. And I think that's great. But I mean, we always prefer to play, of course.
Yeah, we play in real life most times. Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, the old Traveller game was, like, I think, was a pioneer in this because you could roll your characters, you could create starships, you could create systems, and you can just roll on tables and create your own stuff, which I did as a kid. And I think that's kind of cool that you can still interact with the game.
Good way to learn a game, too, I think.
Yeah. It's a good way to get the grips on the system and the setting.
So, and when do you expect this to be fulfilled, do you think?
Early or first quarter of 25.
Yeah.
But we will have an alpha this fall.
Yeah. So an alpha of the full game and of the campaign will drop in this autumn. So people can start playing already this year. But the full release will be in March, I think.
Yeah, that's what we did with Twilight 2000. We started with the alpha, and it was a lot of fun. It was like 99% there. There's a few things that changed at the end, but there was
a lot of C page XX.
We play test our own games, you know, when they're in like a pre alpha state, and it's like. So we want to play with the layout and stuff, but we sit with Word files and it's like, it's ugly. So it's much more nice to have a bit more design to it. Mm-hmm.
That's great. Matt, do you have any other questions that we haven't gone over
that's
yet?
I've got my list. I think that's it for me. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm pretty happy. This is really good. It's always great to talk to designers and kind of get in their head and like, how'd you come up with this? And that's pretty neat for us because it's not our thing. We like playing the games and we like running the games. So it's, and Free League has always been fabulous to us and very supportive. So again, thank you so much for everything you guys do. We really appreciate it as small creators.
But I mean, it's like the hobby is everything. Yeah. You're part of the hobby as well. It's kind
Thank
of,
you.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just, we're just publishers. There's the whole creative stuff is what makes it unique.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Folks watching, listening, I hope you got something out of this. I sure did. Nils, Costa, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been super fun.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thank you. And we'll see you guys next time.
Yeah.
See ya.
See ya.